for hour number two of the Bible study, the Ask the Pastor Hour. Open phones at 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. Our guest for our Bible study conversation in this hour is Pastor Waldemar Vidovskis. He is pastor at Concordia Lutheran Church in Macungie, Pennsylvania, not too far from Philadelphia, as I recall. Morning, Pastor.
Good morning, Chuck.
How are you?
Doing well, thanks.
And the weather in Macungie today?
Brisk.
Brisk.
It's brisk, yeah. It's partly sunny, and I don't know, when I left, it seemed like it was in the teens. It was cold and windy. Yeah.
Any crocuses breaking through the ground there in Macungie?
Not yet. Not this Mardi Gras, not yet.
All right. Well, sir, with your permission, I think we'll go right to work here. There is a story that is out today, and it involves a Pennsylvania boy. Maybe, I don't know if you're familiar with this story or not, but since it's associated with Pennsylvania, I thought, well, you know, it might make some sense to talk with you about it. This comes out of Pittsburgh, and the story from the Associated Press dated today, so this is hot off the press, as they say. The story says the attorney for a Pennsylvania boy accused of gunning down his father's pregnant fiancée last week will ask a judge to move the case to juvenile court and allow the fifth grader to possibly be freed. Dennis Ilisco, the attorney for 11-year-old Jordan Brown, said he will file motions on Monday asking a judge to move the case to juvenile court to let the boy's father post bail so he can get out of jail. I don't think anybody wants him there, Ilisco said, referring to the county jail. Brown has been charged with using his own 20-gauge shotgun to kill 26-year-old Kenzie Marie Houck. Houck was 8 months pregnant with Brown's father's child and also had two daughters, 7 and 4, who lived in the rural home with the Browns, where authorities said she was slain as she lay in bed about 8 o'clock in the morning on Friday. The gun was a Christmas gift from the boy's father, who was training him to be a hunter, according to the New York Daily News on Sunday. Are you familiar with the story, Pastor?
I read it this morning. I did.
You know, perhaps the most troubling thing, well, I guess not the most troubling thing, but something that really caught my attention, is a photograph of the boy who appears to be, at age 11, standing in front of one of those lineup kind of deals, you know, that tell you how tall you are. He's just tall enough to get up into the grid so that you can see how tall he is. And we're just not used to seeing young faces in that setting. But here we are, and my first question to you is, what's going on in Pittsburgh, what's going on in Pennsylvania, or the United States for that matter, that seems to make this kind of crime, this kind of activity, not all that exceptional these days?
Honestly, when you started reading that story, the first thing that came to mind was John chapter 10. Jesus identifies himself as the good shepherd, and he says, the thief comes to steal and kill and destroy. And then he contrasts it, and he says, I have come that they may have life and have it to the full, or have it abundantly. And what's going on in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and New York and Omaha and Kansas City, Denver, you know, Muleshoe, Texas, all of those places, is that Satan's time is short, and his goal, and I think you touched on this, I didn't hear much of your program, but a couple bits and pieces the last hour, Satan comes to steal and kill and destroy. He wants to just dismantle our society. And he starts with the family and stealing away innocence from children. And there were some issues that were in the paper also here this weekend, which we could talk about too, about kids and just sexuality and where our society is going that way. And this boy is certainly not the problem, but he's a symptom of the problem and the sickness that's in our society right now.
So in saying this boy is not the problem, and I want to be as genuine as I can be here, You know, there are those who would say, I don't care if he's 11 or 9 or whatever he is, put him in jail, throw away the key. There are people who would say that. I'm not one of them. But I am a little troubled by the notion that he could take a shotgun, kill a 26-year-old pregnant woman, and now his attorney, apparently, according to this story, is asking a judge to move the case to juvenile court, which would allow him to be free. Should he be free? Now, I'm assuming that free does not necessarily mean no consequences for his behavior whatsoever, but at least that he wouldn't have to be sitting in jail as he is today. Should he be allowed to go free, Pastor?
Well, I think there are multiple unanswered questions in those news headlines. The way that it played in our local paper was that the request, again, I'm sure this is unfolding hour by hour. You know, it's 12:15, and all this took place on Saturday, and so nobody worked yesterday. They put him in jail, and today now everybody sat down is kind of working on the case. But some of the facets of this, I'm sure, include the legal situation and the situation in the prison or the jail that he's in. The way it played in our local paper was it was actually the warden of the prison asked for him to be moved, because they had no place to house him. The article in the Allentown Morning Call said that they have him in a holding cell, which is literally in the lobby of the prison. It's like when somebody checks in, they put him in there while they process the paperwork. And they said, you know, they have no clothes to fit a 10-year-old boy. They can't put him in a cell block with adults. They can't bathe unless they lock down a cell block of, you know, they said 65 cells or... You know, that, you know, they have to lock the whole thing down, you know, for him to come into, you know, some sort of facility to get cleaned up. And so basically he's locked in the lobby of this prison. And so the way it played in our paper was that the warden of the prison wants to get him out of the adult prison into a juvenile situation. I'm sure now that lawyers are there and on the scene, they have their own motivation and so on. And the other facet of this, which we don't know, is what was his home situation? You know, was he abusive? What, you know... was it violent? Was he, you know, why, you know, what was behind this? Is he an angry kid?
Is an 11-year-old kid old enough to know better, Pastor?
I don't know. I have an 11-year-old who's pretty bright, and I don't know. You know, here it is. You know, you could start legally slicing this out. I have an 11-year-old who certainly knows the difference between right and wrong, and certainly would know that killing someone is wrong. But I'm not certain my 11-year-old could think through the implications of the consequences of his actions, you know, the permanence of death or facing the death penalty or this. And so, I wouldn't know what would motivate him. You know, if you just look on its face, it's murder in the first degree, and certainly courts then take into consideration, planning or premeditation, I guess is the word I'm looking for. Whether it was premeditated, was it an act of passion, you know, was it self-defense, and somebody's going to have to, in the next few days, somebody's going to have to sort those things out for that kid.
It says here in the story that after the shooting, the boy hopped onto a school bus with Houck's oldest daughter.
And went to school.
He was picked up from school several hours later after some tree trimmers called 911 when Houck's youngest daughter told them she thought her mother was dead. The lawyer, Lisco, says a judge likely won't hear his motions right away. Until then, he hopes to get the fifth grader's school to send him his assignments in jail. There's something about that that just blows me away.
Yeah. For an 11-year-old, that sounds pretty callous. Again, so you begin to wonder what his situation was that if you could shoot somebody, and I don't know if I could ever do that, but if you would, I think I'd be pretty upset about it. I wouldn't just resume my normal life, and it is. It's what I guess what's offensive to us, and I think maybe this is sort of what's eating at you a little bit, is that in our world, and according to our values, I'm going to say as American, you know, as Christians, but just as Americans, there used to be sort of this value system that we held as a society that kids are supposed to be innocent. And we can take it if this was some, you know, cold-blooded murderer, you know, living on the streets, you know, some transient, you know, nobody would notice, and I'm sure crimes like this go on all the time, that don't get a headline. They get, you know, just a line in the police blotter, such and such killed such and such, and they're in jail now, and we think, okay, you know, it's probably where they belong. But when it's an 11-year-old kid and he's got homework and he's got a future and children are supposed to be innocent, you know, all of those values that we have are now being offended when we hear this story and read the headlines. And that, again, gets back to my starting point, which is the thief comes to steal and to kill and destroy. Satan comes to take that which is innocent and pollute it. And you can see that in child pornography. You can see that in the ages that you know, young girls are getting pregnant or becoming sexually active. You can see that in the ages of young girls having abortions and you know, all the statistics you read about, you know, the innocence of our children, or what you can see on television and in the movies, it just is desensitizing our society, and it's a whole set of values that is foreign to us. Again, I'm going to say, as Americans who grew up in this country, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, this is totally new to us. But as Christians, it's completely contrary to the value system that is laid out for us in Scripture and that we cling to as God's people. And that's the extra offense of this murder, is that this child is, by our measure, should be innocent, and he's involved in such a heinous, and what we would even say, it's such an adult kind of a crime.
So, do you teach confirmation to young people?
I do.
At Concordia Mukunji? How old are those kids typically when they're confirmed?
As young as 11 or 12 and as old as 15 or 16. It's sort of that span between 11 and 16.
Now, over the years, in my experience, there has been a little bit of a debate going on. It's not an earth-shaking debate as to whether or not we're making a mistake by confirming children typically in the eighth grade. I think maybe let's just use the age 14 here as a kind of an average, that maybe we shouldn't be confirming them at age 14 because they're not ready. And maybe we should be waiting till the end of high school, something like that. And some of the old timers, I got to be careful here because I'm turning into an old timer myself, but some of the old timers would say, you know, when I was a boy, when I was a young person, young people worked and they had responsibility. And this business of, you know, getting a car and running around and being irresponsible and not having a job because mom and dad take care of everything, that's not the way it used to be a couple of generations back. You got up early in the morning and you worked on the farm or you worked in the business or whatever and you fit school in there. And by the time you were 14, you were well on your way to being an adult. Have you ever heard people describe that in that way, Pastor?
Personally, I can't say no. I can say no, but I do resonate and I understand and appreciate that. I know people of that generation who I know men personally who lied about their age to sign up to go fight in World War II.
Yeah.
You know, so you're talking again these 16-year-old boys who were mature enough to say, I love my country and I want to fight for her. But it's true. I grew up in the Midwest in Nebraska, and a lot of kids and friends of mine. I didn't grow up on a farm, but I associated with a lot of people who did. You know, as soon as you're old enough to reach the pedals, you were driving a tractor or a farm truck, you know, and regardless
right.
of you were 13 or, you know, whatever, there's no, you know,
some,
you're doing
some pretty
the work
dangerous the, work sometimes.
Yeah, you're doing the job because it had to be done, you know, and if, you know, when you're little, maybe you start out feeding the chickens, and then as soon as you're strong enough, you're, you know, baling hay or, you know, feeding the hogs or, you know, whatever. But, you know, the work had to be done, and whoever was able did it. Man, woman, or child.
Those of us parents, and you say you have an 11-year-old, you have other children?
Yes, I do.
How old are they?
My oldest is just all, we're turning 17 in March, and then I have a 15-year-old boy, Micah. So those are my two in high school. And then I have two younger boys, Noel and Oliver, they are 11 and 9.
Well, you're right then up to your eyeballs in parenting. And my question is, from your perspective, have we not just perhaps failed, but have we sinned as parents by delaying the responsibilities of adulthood for young people, by not expecting them to get a job, by just expecting them to do well in school in such a way that they don't really have anything in the way of responsibility until perhaps they go off to college, or maybe they go off in the military? Have we done something wrong there?
Yeah, you know, I think there are different societal values. There's a whole kind of an issue where, you know, this sense of the difference between children and adults. You know, if you go back to the Middle Ages, there was a time when there was little distinction between children and adults, and the whole issue of, you know, child labor. And, you know, this kind of cuts both ways. You know, this isn't a very simple thing, because, you know, when we talk about a 12 or 13-year-old kid working on the farm, that seems very normal and natural to me. But if you're talking about, you know, a 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old girl in, say in China or Taiwan, working, you know, 12 hours a day at a factory, we might think differently about that. And so there are different kinds of child labor issues. What's appropriate for that? But I think as a society, and it's not just kids, but even adults, we have a tough time taking responsibility and being mature. When I was in college, I took an adolescence class, and one of the lines that stuck with me is that adolescence has a biological onset and it has a psychological ending, and sometimes people never reach it. And I would say, not only have we not challenged our 12, 13, 14, 15-year-olds to take responsibility for themselves and their actions, but I think sometimes adults grow up with having never reached that end of that psychological end of adolescence. They're 23 years old. They finished college. They have a ton of debt. They're living home with mom and dad, and they have no incentive to get a job because mom and dad are gonna pay the way. And I just want to sit home, watch TV, play some video games. You know, maybe I'll get a job at the sub shop so I can have a nice car. You know, and I have kids in my community like that who work at the local amusement park. They have a $40,000 pickup truck with all the latest chrome, and they live at home with mom and dad. You know, man, I wish I could have a car, you know, like that. But they, you know, they, and it's like they're 23, 24 years old. They have no sense of ambition or responsibility. They're just going to live off of mom and dad. And so it's not only 12 and 14 year olds, it's older kids. And so there is a sense of that we have not allowed our kids to take responsibility. The other, let's look at the other coin, the other side of the coin. The other side of the coin is it recognizes also that, and this is the issue with, an example of one of the big hot political issues is, can a 14-year-old girl have an abortion without telling her parents? You know, this girl can't get her ears pierced until she's 18 without a parent sitting there, but she can have an abortion at 14 without telling her parents because that's her body and her right. There's something really screwed up about that. And
no doubt.
And so the reason there's that law about the ear piercing is simply because that sometimes kids who are 15 and 16 are not emotionally mature enough to recognize the implications of their actions. In our society, we've also placed a high level of importance on education, that we believe it's more important for our 13-year-old to be learning math and reading than cranking out widgets in a factory.
Well, are we
let me just finish the thought.
Sure.
And you've gone. So that in the long run, that person will have a better life. Our society will be stronger because they spent those adolescent years in school getting an education rather than finishing out school in eighth grade and going working in the coal mine or in the factory or on the farm. Even farming today is a very highly complex and technical thing, and it's just not manual labor any longer. Go ahead.
Are we supposed to feel sorry for this 11-year-old boy? Do you feel sorry for him? The lawyer says, and this is a quote, "I want him to be occupied and busy and back, essentially in school. I wouldn't say he's in good spirits. He's confused. He looks and acts like a typical 11-year-old boy." No, he doesn't. typical 11-year-old boys don't take shotguns and shoot 28-year-old pregnant women. And if this boy were in your 11-year-old's class at school, and I don't know what "I want him busy and back essentially in school" exactly means, but if it means back sitting in the desk next to your child, do you have a problem with that, Pastor?
Yeah, I don't know. I can't answer that in, as a yes or a no. I'm so sure I could say, yeah, I got a problem with that. But, again, for me, whether this is my pastor self or my psychological self or whatever, I want to know what led him to shoot that woman, and what was he thinking? Is that a violent environment? You know, there's a whole other issue behind video games and again what we see on television. You know, and for the most part, we have not allowed our children to play video games because many of them are so violent. And just recently, my 15-year-old son got a video game. It doesn't have guns, but it has sort of these medieval weapons. And I watched him play it for a few minutes, and I thought, oh, my gosh, what did we do? You know, we've got 15 years, and he has not played these games, and now he's running around bludgeoning, you know, trolls, you know? And, and again, when I think of what some of these video games are that are very popular, they sit there for 3 or 4 or 5, 6 hours a day, bludgeoning, shooting, blowing up, exploding, bombing, grenading, things, and you just become numb and desensitized to that. And again, is this a function of that in this kid's life? And I'm gonna, here, let me play the devil's advocate. Maybe he's the most mature person in that house, and maybe it was a horrible thing, and she was abusing him and his dad and his sisters, or whatever. And he just said, this has got to stop. And maybe he's the hero.
Well, the lawyer, Lisco is his name, said jail officials can't even find clothes to fit the 4'8" boy.
Yeah, his pants are rolled up 10
yeah,
times.
It says they put a shirt on it, he's swimming in it, and his pants are cuffed up about 10 times. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, that's not his problem. Whether he's swimming in his shirt or his pants are cuffed up about 10 times, that's really not his problem here.
That he can, in cold blood, kill someone, get on a bus and go about his daily life is the part that's most troubling to me.
I think he's got more problems than the fact that his clothes are too big here. But then maybe I'm just an insensitive, heartless guy. I don't know. What do you think?
No, I think you're right. I think the thing that's most disturbing about that is that I'm going to say here I'm going to make a huge judgment here, but I'm going to say a normal person would be shaken up after something like that. If it was an accident or a crime of passion, the impression the article gives is that he was not shaken up. He put the gun down, washed his hands, went to school, and like nothing happened. And that's the part that's frightening to me.
We are talking with Pastor Waldemar Vanoskis today here on our Ask the Pastor program. I'm interested in what some of you may think about this. Do you feel sorry for this boy? Do you think he should be tried as an adult? Right now, he is charged as an adult. Do you think that he should be moved to a juvenile situation? Maybe someday he'll be free again. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. During 2009, we will spend the entire year observing the 85th anniversary of AM 850 KFUO, and we'd like very much to have your assistance. Over the years, tens of thousands of people have listened to KFUO, and thousands have visited our station. You may have a special KFUO memory. We'd like you to share that memory with us. And we've set aside a telephone line where you can record your special KFUO memory. That number is 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Perhaps you remember a special program, or appreciated a particular KFUO voice. Whatever your special memory is, we invite you to share it with us at 1-800-737-0172. Please tell us your name and hometown and make your message brief. The number again is 1-800-737-0172.
When a caterpillar turns into a butterfly, what happens to its brain? Details are next on today's Creation Moments. And now, here's our Creation Moments host, Ian Taylor.
The metamorphosis of a caterpillar into a moth or butterfly completely restructures the creature internally and externally. Think of it. In this metamorphosis or transition stage, the little creature actually turns into a liquid. Scientists at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. wondered whether that also included the caterpillar's brain. To find out, they placed tobacco hornworm caterpillars inside a hollow tube shaped like a letter Y. Scientists then put a bad-smelling gas in one of the upper arms of the Y. When the caterpillar crawled into that arm of the tube, it also received a mild electric shock. Since caterpillars go through several molts, researchers performed the experiment on caterpillars at various stages of their moltings. They found that caterpillars that underwent the experience before their fifth and final molt did not remember their experience with the gas after metamorphosis. However, 77% of those caterpillars that encountered the gas and experienced the shock after their final molt remember their dislike of the gas after metamorphosis. Scientists point out that caterpillars, moths, and butterflies are not social creatures. This means they have more need for memory because there is no division of labor among them. Just because the Bible associates moths with decay doesn't mean that God didn't provide them with all that they need to live successful lives. To God, no creature is unimportant.
To purchase a copy of Ian Taylor's book, In the Minds of Men, call us toll-free at 800-42-BIBLE or visit us online at creationmoments.com.
When it's so cold outside that eating ice cream seems like a good way to warm up, you're ready for some relief from those midwinter blues. Well, here's just the prescription for what ails you. Stroll through the Victorian charm of Henry's Garden, where you'll be embraced in the warmth of the colors and fragrances of over 8,000 orchids, arrayed in a courtyard setting straight out of yesteryear. You can forget about winter daily at the Missouri Botanical Garden's 91st Annual Orchid Show from 9 to 5 through March 15th. For more information, contact mobot.org.
With Eagle numbers climbing to new heights, Eagle programming is just getting off the ground, with events happening throughout the month of February. In a recent Eagle count conducted by the World Bird Sanctuary, 2,154 Eagles were counted between Quincy and Alton. Now that's the largest Eagle count since 1983. It's an event you won't want to miss. To learn more, visit this website, visitalton.com. That's visitalton.com.
This is the Ask the Pastor Bible Study. I'm Chuck Rathert. Pastor Waldemar Vanoskis is with us here today. He is pastor at Concordia Lutheran Church in Macungie, Pennsylvania, 505-7850-1800-730-2727. One more question on this story involving this 11-year-old boy who used a shotgun on his father's girlfriend, pregnant girlfriend. The child currently is charged under Pennsylvania law, which allows children as young as 10 to be charged with criminal homicide, and he is currently charged as an adult. One thing, and this is one of the things that his lawyer is arguing to get him out of that adult system into the juvenile system, one thing that I always find fascinating about these kinds of episodes, Pastor, is that we don't seem to have much clarity on what is a juvenile and what's an adult. And there are times when very young people can be charged as an adult and they stand trial as an adult and they face adult penalties. And I don't get that. Can't we all get together and figure out, you know, what constitutes a child under the law and what constitutes an adult? And if we're going to have a juvenile court system with penalties which are designed to punish children, essentially, and an adult system with penalties designed to charge adults, why do we confuse those things, do you think?
Well, again, I'm not a lawyer or a psychologist, but my opinion or understanding would be that some of the issue gets back to what we were talking about maturity, that there certainly are psychological changes that take place in people or when adolescence sets in, that children simply do not have this sort of concrete operational thought. They're not able to think abstractly and make those kind of abstract connections, which again have to do with did you realize that when you push this trigger, this person would die? Or did you realize that if you did this, that you'd go to prison for life? You know, that they can't think through that abstractly. And so there's that. And so this, whatever, that's an emotional maturity or a psychological maturity, that they're not able to make those kinds of rational, reasonable, and responsible decisions than an adult could. So I think that's sort of what's behind this distinction between children and adults. But who's a child and who's an adult, and how you charge someone betrays really your value system, you know, what you believe about, you know, certain moral situations and decisions. And the one I mentioned earlier was the abortion one. You know, the other one, that this was in the paper not too long ago around here, but it was an 18-year-old boy who had sex with his 17-year-old girlfriend, and he got charged with statutory rape. Okay, so is that the same, an 18-year-old boy having sex with a 17-year-old girl, is that the same as a 40-year-old man having sex with a 14-year-old girl? It's the same legally, it's the same crime, but I think there's something different going on. And so you have to make a moral judgment of whether you're going to press charges, and so on. Or, again, the other extreme would be an 11-year-old boy shooting an adult with a shotgun, and a 17-year-old boy shooting an 18-year-old, you know, boy in a gang or something, okay?
Yeah.
So is that the same, that when a 17-year-old does that to an 18-year-old, as an 11-year-old doing it to a 28-year-old? You know, you have to really ask the question, how are those things different and why? And those become value judgments and moral judgments about what we believe about children and adults and so on. And some of those things are backed up by science, like psychology, and some of those are purely subjective.
505-7850-1800-730-2727. Rick, you're on the Bible study.
Oh, thanks for taking the call. And Pastor, did I hear you introduced as Pastor Wally?
Wally is fine. My given name is Waldemar. Most people don't have trouble with that, so they call me Wally. Pastor
okay.
V will work, too.
Okay. Well, the 11-year-old, I do feel sorry for him. Something horribly gone wrong in that young man's life. The father, how can ammunition and a weapon be so available to people in the household of that age?
Well, that it was the father's desire to teach the boy to hunt. He is 11 years old. It's not unusual
right.
for an 11-year-old
right.
to learn that from his father. And so he got the shotgun and the ammunition for Christmas.
But these things should be locked up, not just so readily available. Should be under an adult supervision. I think the father, wanting to do a good thing, had gone horribly wrong here. And something that we spoke about in the earlier hour, it kind of ties in with this. Our fight is not with flesh and blood, but it's a spiritual thing. And I think there is a spiritual element that goes into this that nobody really considers, of what was controlling this young man's life to take the steps to do what he had done.
All right, let's see what the pastor has to say.
Okay, thank you.
Well, again, there are two dimensions to this. One with regards to the firearm. I think the caller is correct that, you know, I took hunter safety when I was again 10 or 11 years old, and again, some of the things I can remember back 30 years ago or 35 years ago were that you do store your firearms and your ammunition separately. You do keep those things locked up, particularly if there are children in the house and so on. On the other hand, I have good friends who have a gun safe, and it's always open and unlocked. The door swung wide open, you know. So, you know, it's good that you have that gun safe, but unless the door's shut, that doesn't really help. And so there's certainly a responsibility issue on the adult. You know, again, here's the difference. The adults are the ones or who's supposed to be the adults in that situation. And sure, the guy has a gun. You know, sure, he got it for Christmas. Sure, he can hang it on his wall in his bedroom. But you probably want to keep those shotgun shells locked up, I would think, for that simple reason that even 11-year-olds, and I know I did this as a kid. You go out and you grab the 22 shells and you go run shooting everything, you know. It's a miracle I'm alive that I didn't shoot myself, you know. And so in that sense, when you got a 10 or 11-year-old kid, and like I said, my son Noel, who's 11, is a very thoughtful and responsible kid. I would never give him a loaded firearm unsupervised. You know, it's a recipe for disaster. And so there's an adult needing the adult there. The other side of it is the spiritual side of it. And certainly there is some great hurt, a spiritual dysfunction or a spiritual oppression on that house that has manifested itself in the death of this woman at the hands of this child. And that is really the problem in our society. And there's the call for us as a church. You know, when Rick was talking, I just had a flashback to my first parish. It was Lent. It either was in my vicarage year or the first year I was back. It was Lent. A family came and visited, a man, his wife, and four daughters. And they had never been to our church. They had stopped and visited. We greeted them. We sent them a letter. We went out and made an evangelism call. And they never really came back. But people walk into churches all the time because they're looking for something, God, hope, forgiveness, you know, whatever. And so we reached out to them a little, okay, sent a letter, made a visit, but we never really connected. They never came back to the church. That was Lent. That following August, that man murdered his wife and his four daughters and killed himself in his home. And it was a devastating thing for our community. And I thought to myself, I sat in that living room and talked to that guy. And I'm guessing when they came to church that Lent, that springtime, there was something going on in his life and in his family's life that they were looking for God and an answer. And sadly, we were not able to provide that for them, that kind of ministry, or bring the gospel to them in a way that answered their question or touched them, or in the midst of that spiritual battle, Satan has, the spirit is drawing them to God and to our church, and Satan is fighting against that. And sadly, in that situation, I believe Satan prevailed. The man despaired, and it was a horrible, horrible story.
So, Pastor,
the reason I tell this story is that for us as the church, we have the medicine. The challenge is that when somebody comes into our church to seek it out, how can we as Christians, pastors, people, neighbors, Christian neighbors, reach out to our neighbors and people in our community who are hurting and need the medicine? And that medicine is the gospel of Jesus Christ, his death and resurrection for the forgiveness of sins, and the power of the Holy Spirit to remove sin and Satan from their lives and to fill them with God's love and hope and eternal life. Okay, go ahead.
That's an interesting scenario you described there, and I could see where you could pray one of two very different prayers. You might pray a prayer of confession and sorrow to God that somehow, some way, you did not detect the difficulty in the family and were not in a position to offer the love of God, which might have somehow avoided that very unfortunate outcome. Or you might be praying a very thankful prayer to God that you didn't get to know him better, and therefore your church was shielded from some of the church violence that we've seen in the last couple of years, where people in church have been injured or killed by people who are somehow very distressed.
Well, I could tell you honestly that story is about 15. It happened about 15 years ago in my life, and I'll tell you, I prayed that first prayer a lot more than I ever prayed that second prayer. We just went through a whole time of hand wringing and so kind of soul searching as a church and as pastors of, is there something more we could have done? And the answer is sure, all there always is, but you just don't know, And so it is. It was a very
I want to ask you the toughest question.
Go
And this is, if I were to ask this question out there in the marketplace, I might very well get hooted down, shouted down for even asking this question, because of the permissive society in which we live. But as a pastor, as a theologian, somebody who handles the Word of God, how do you respond to this question? This problem here with this 11-year-old boy is much more complicated because he was apparently, based on the story that we have today from the AP, is apparently living in a house where his father has in his house a woman who is not his wife, to whom he is not married. She is described as a fiancée here. She has two daughters, and the...
They're not his.
They're not his, and she is pregnant with his child. This is all, I think, strictly forbidden by the Sixth Commandment and any of a variety of other places in Scripture that I could point to. And the situation, as I just described it, is evil. Right about there is where people would start shouting me down as being judgmental and offensive. But since there's nobody here in the studio, I can continue. The evil begins with the father and with the parents here. And the boy is a victim of that environment and that spiritually evil environment. If somebody were to make that argument, how would you respond?
Well, I agree with you. I think that I wouldn't make it say as crassly as you just described.
That's
it.
Pretty crass, huh, Pastor?
Well, not crass, but you know what you said is accurate. And I don't know, crass isn't the word I'm looking for, but bluntly, maybe that's the word. Maybe that's it, is bluntly. It's not crass. What you said is accurate. It's true. That we live in a society that thumbs its nose at God's Word, God's will, and God's law, and we think that we can live these lives apart from God's Word and will and law revealed to us in the Holy Scriptures, and do it with impunity. You know that there's no consequences. It's sort of like our economic situation. We can be greedy and steal from people, and nothing will happen. Well, it's happening now. You know, and so there are consequences. And same in our society. You know, whoever they are in our society, glory in dismantling marriage as an institution between man and woman, but they have no idea or cannot appreciate the evil consequences of structuring a society where there is no family or bond, where just some guy and some woman hook up and start producing children, and then she hooks up with someone else and she has more children, and the first ones are not the first guys, and then she hooks up with somebody else and you got the third ones. You know, it's the whole California thing right now, this woman out of wedlock,
sure,
14 kids, and it's insane.
Well, that makes you and me not very cool,
we
Pastor.
Are, it's true, Chuck, we are not very cool, but all of these things have implications, and so people, you know, think it's very popular, and probably this also was kind of pointed out at the Academy Awards last night. It's really cool, you know, to have gay marriage, you know. But I'll tell you that our civilization, you know, since written history has been based on the family unit being a man and woman and children. And I would also argue, biologically, we are mammals. Okay, God created us to reproduce heterosexually. That's why we're mammals, and that's what we do, and that's part of how creation works. And when you disrupt God's creation,
Of course you're an enlightened free spirit, Pastor.
And so it is not popular, and I can tell you that me saying this is fuel for those who battle against family and marriage. And so, again, I think that when you see this boy in this family situation, that is a symptom of the brokenness of the home. And Christians haven't helped. You know, the divorce rate amongst Christians or those who do the surveys, the number of Christians having premarital sex just plays into this. And so Christians have nothing to boast about, we also need to repent for our carelessness, because we are right now not part of the solution that are contributing to the problem, of which, again, this situation is just an example. It's not the problem, but it's an example of what's going wrong. And I, again, as a pastor, I have to say, I know what we need to do to reclaim it, and at the same time, I say, I don't know what we can do,
Let's take a call here, 505-750-1800-730-2727. Hi, Jeff, you're on the Bible study.
Well, good morning, fellows. How are you guys doing?
Doing all right. How are you doing?
Oh, well, doing well. We talk about the destruction of the family. I just kind of like caught the last 5 minutes of it or so. But that is the topic, right?
More or less. It certainly fits in context with this story of this 11-year-old boy who shot his father's fiance.
Wow, yeah. I guess it all starts at the home and the church. Unfortunately, over the last 50, 60 years, this country's gotten away from a church-based education and has allowed the secularist, humanist to take over the children and teach them in public schools.
Wow, that's quite an indictment there, Jeff.
Well, I think I could back it up. You look what's going on. And not only the school systems, but also the courts. In 1976, we passed a law for no-fault divorce in the state of Missouri. And since that time, the divorce rate has skyrocketed. And you got to kind of point the finger there, too.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Appreciate your time.
Any comments, Pastor?
Yeah, I have nothing to really disagree with Jeff. I think he's on track, and I think... it's something I preach regularly to my congregation, is that our calling as Christians is not just to serve in the church, but to serve in our community. That at minimum, as Christians, we need to vote. And that would be the minimum. It would be simply to participate. I may go as far as saying it is sinful for an American citizen, a Christian who's an American citizen, to not vote.
That wow.
Is, what a privilege God has given us and called us to be citizens. And if we do not vote or participate in some level of our democracy, then we cannot complain about other people with other values. People with values contrary to ours, they're very active politically. And so I think it behooves us as Christians to vote and to be active citizens. Beyond voting, I think Christians should be active and involved in their local school districts. They should be active and involved in their local politics. Two things move people in Washington, or for us in Harrisburg, or for you guys in Springfield?
Missouri?
Yes.
St. Louis?
What's your capital?
Oh, the Jefferson City is the capital.
Oh, Jefferson
Missouri.
City. Yeah. So two things move people in positions of government, and one is money. And the other is just people, feet, in Washington, D.C., it's feet on the hill. If you can go and make an appointment with your representative in Washington, D.C., which is pretty easy for us to do in Pennsylvania, it's two and a half hour drive, to be there in their office, in their face, and say, this is what I need from my government. They'll listen. Or you can write them a check. if you don't have money, you got to be active. Write a letter. So when your congressman or senator is home, you go see them, you talk to them. Christians need to do that. They need to serve in local governments, city councils or municipal boards. It's our Christian calling. And if we don't, then we cannot complain when people who have different values than us start taking over those institutions. It's a democracy. We all have a seat at the table. And I think Christians for too long have given up. They've not stepped up.
Well, when I described for you the... Sixth Commandment situation, as at least the Associated Press gave it to us, as a man living with a woman without the benefit of marriage, with her children in the house, she's pregnant by him, all of these things, which would seem to be a sinful situation. You said that was crass, and then you were kind enough to pull that back and say, well, it's direct. Maybe here's what it is. Maybe it's hate speech. By saying that, and you agreeing with me, we have judged those folks who are listening to us right now who may be living in exactly the same situation. They haven't had any shotgun murders in their homes, and they're quite content and happy with their situation. And who are you, or who am I, to be judging their situation and calling it evil? That's hate speech, Pastor. How do you respond?
Well, I think that the term hate speech is a tool that is used to put down Christians with whom they disagree. But I guess the point of the crass or the blunt I meant is simply that as a pastor I deal with people in those situations all the time, and I could walk around swinging the Bible and the law and just hitting anybody in my wake, which is Christians are sometimes pretty good at that. It's much harder to do it more like a surgeon wielding, instead of an axe or some blunt object, to use a scalpel to excise that tumor, to apply law and gospel in a precise way to crush the sinner, to kill them, and B, then to make them alive through the gospel. And that for us as Christians, we like to stand up and identify whatever ill of society and yell about it. But then to actually make a difference in someone who's in a situation like that. You know, again, my favorite one is the abortion situation. It's easy for Christians to stand and hold up signs and say, "You're killing your child." It's much harder to go to that woman and say, "I understand you're in a crisis pregnancy. Would you come and live at our house for these next 9 months, and we'll feed you and care for you? Could we get you some doctor care or pay your medical bills, or could we, provide you, work or some other aid to help you, or an option for adoption, so that when you do carry this child to term, that you'll have your baby will have someplace to go." It's much easier to just hold the sign and then let them, try to be a single person out of wedlock, pregnant with no job and no money, and say, you're killing your baby. I've done this pastor thing for 16 years, and I'm tired of people complaining about sin in our society and then doing nothing. That the fifth commandment is you shall not murder. That's the negative. The positive, you should help and befriend your neighbor in every physical need. And so how are Christians complicit when we, by an act of omission, do not help and befriend our neighbor in every physical need? Easy to hold up the sign, much harder to care for somebody. And so, again, there's plenty of crass rebellion against God and His Word, but Christians need to step up and love our neighbor back to God. And it's both law and gospel. It's got to be the saving message to bring them back.
Pastor, thank you for the time. Enjoy the conversation. God's blessings on you and the people in Pennsylvania.
Listen to Chuck rather than guests.
That's Pastor Waldemar Vanofskis, our guest here on our Ask the Pastor program. Tomorrow, Pastor John Lekomsky takes us into Mark chapter 4, first 25 verses. And our Ask the Pastor guest will be Pastor Don Moore, St. Paul, Apopka, Florida.
St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the Internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of the Bible study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible Study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.